The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to the Future Proof Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, sending us your emails and your comments and your thoughts. We will get to those later in the program, but it's good to have you here. If you would like to comment on anything you hear, we get to everything later on in the podcast. So if you email us this week, next week we'll be talking about it. That's science@newstalk.com. And we do read all of your emails, no matter how colourful. So this week we're going to be talking about there's no way to sugarcoat this. We're going to be talking about what you can learn from the wax inside a whale's ear. It's pretty gross. I'll be honest with you. The interview is pretty gross, but it's also very interesting. Now, on Friday, that was Friday 15th of March. If you're listening to this, you know, in the future, what is it like? I was at the children's march. I sat down, I talked with my son, and there is this sort of you're chatting to your son and you realize that, you know, he doesn't really have, you know, if he's 7 years old, he hasn't got the capacity fully to comprehend the complexity of it, because he doesn't really understand the outside world and the problems that we have as human beings, even just in our day to day, let alone the global socioeconomic issues that are associated with climate change, right? So I'm sitting down with him the night before and I said, look, here's what's happening. Do you want to go? And of course, he knows, you know, like Clever Hans, you know, the horse. You know Clever Hans, Aidan? No. Clever Hans was a horse, I think in the 18th century, that could count. And people used to come far and wide, and Clever Hans would travel around the place counting. And people would go, oh my God. And what would happen was Clever Hans would turn up and Clever Hans' owner would say, what's 4 plus 4? And Clever Hans would go, and it raises hoof to go again. And then the guy would go, yeah! And very quickly, of course, Clever Hans figured out when he heard yeah, he would stop hoofing and he would get a sugar. So I liken my child to this literal show pony. And I realize it may seem like an unfair comparison, but I'm only doing it on one level. So that's okay. And that level is, I feel like I sort of indoctrinated him to say, yes, I'll go to the climate change march. But also I thought, you know, I mean, there were a few people, I have to say, a very small minority. We should, probably shouldn't have given them as much of a representation in the media as did happen, that were saying, oh, you know, they're just mitching from school and blah, blah, blah. And I'll say this in the podcast. I won't say it on air because, I don't know, I feel a bit embarrassed about it, to be honest. But I went there and I did actually start to well up. Now, before I get into it, right, before I get into I will say this. My family watch me and not the ends of movies. When we get to the end of a movie, they turn around and they start looking at me. And my wife points at me, and as soon as the first tear goes down my cheek, and then everyone starts laughing at me. And it's a very unpleasant way to enjoy a film, actually. But I get moved by pictures. I get easily moved. And I was at this march, and I saw all these young people, and I was thinking, like, quite literally, you know, to dismiss this as mitching off school or like not really, you know, not really getting it. Like they are marching out of a concern, a very real concern about their very real future. And that was inspiring, but also really sad that that's actually what they were marching for. They were marching to have a cleaner planet. Like that's terrifying. And so I went along with the march and I brought him, and I thought it was a good idea. And it was inspiring to me, to see so many people in Dublin, and I know this is replicated across the world, so wherever you were, I know people marched. But I have a horrible feeling that there are people going, yeah, well, it's just kids or blah, blah, blah. They are the people who are going to have to live in the world that we are currently not doing enough to protect. And, you know, this tendency in some parts of media and society sort of brush off the environmental movement as being A, lefty, B, liberal, C, tree huggy, or whatever it is, and sometimes, you know, feminizing it, or, you know, it really is one of the most toxic ideas that is out there. I was inspired to be there. I was happy to have my son there, and I just wanted to say, if you went to march, good on you. It does matter. And for those kids who are there, hopefully that will start a thinking in you, a skepticism, a questioning in you about what we're doing. Because, you know, I'll read some of the emails and I'll get into it. This is going to be a long podcast, by the way, because we have a few things to talk about. So anyway, if you marched, good on you. Now, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and patiently waiting here all this time are Dr. Susan Keller and Dr. Laura Duggan. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
If my trunk was that small, I wouldn't draw attention to myself, pal.
Give me a break. We've been waddling all day.
Oh, go ahead. Follow the crowd. It'll be quieter when you're gone.
Come on. He wants to freeze to death, let him.
As any parent will know, that is Manny the Mammoth from the Ice Age movies. And we've talked about this idea of bringing back mammoths so many times, Laura, but we've taken one step further for some reason.
Yeah, so this, for some reason, wow, I love it. Science for the sake of science. So this is a new paper published in Scientific Reports, and it's again more people trying to bring back the woolly mammoth. So there is a 28,000-year-old woolly mammoth called Yuka that was found in Siberian permafrost. And they found her 8 years ago, and they've been using her cells and her DNA to try and resurrect the woolly mammoth. And what this new paper shows is that they took the nucleus from one of the cells and they put it into a mouse ova, so an egg with its nucleus taken out. And that's one of the ways that you can clone. That's the idea. Mm-hmm. And the ova has all these brilliant abilities to turn on a nucleus that you wouldn't get in a cell from, say, your skin or from your muscle. So they put it in. And the cell did its absolute best to try and turn it on, and it 100% couldn't. And I think it's really important because all the headlines are like, we're a step closer to you know, bringing back the woolly mammoth. And actually what this paper proved is that at the moment and with our methods, it's essentially impossible. So it started to do the bits that you need to be done just before a cell divides, and then it all came to a massive crashing halt, and it cannot repair the DNA because it is 28,000 years of rotting bacteria and ultraviolet light. So we will not be replicating a mammoth this way. I'm not even really sure why it's such a big paper, to be completely honest. It's proving that you can't do it this way. Now, there's other groups trying to do it by tinkering with elephant DNA.
So we're not a step closer.
We're actually just not at all. I mean, there's maybe tens of thousands of base pairs in these mammoths' DNA, which are still intact. But, you know, the base pairs are usually in strings of millions and millions and billions. We're so far away from being able to take this. I mean, they're even saying nucleus. It's probably just strands of DNA, really. Mm. So the mouse cell did its best to try and fix them and repair them. It absolutely couldn't, and it came to a crashing halt. We're no closer to having a mammoth at all. But look, they still got a paper out of it, and it was still a Nature, well, Scientific Reports paper.
The question is, like, is this an area that we're likely to see going down, despite the fact that many people say we shouldn't? Is it likely, as in the you know, the story of the Chinese scientist who put edited embryos in a pregnant mother, in a mum, and they actually came into the world?
Yep.
Are we likely to see this, do you think? Because while 100 or 99% of scientists agree that we shouldn't be trying to bring back the mammoth, are there people who are going to continue down the path?
It is absolutely going to happen. So what I know, I would assume they're going to do is they're going to sequence more and more of the mammoth DNA, and then they're going to start inserting that into elephant eggs. So they're going to take, you know, an already fairly endangered animal, and they're going to start tinkering with that. And they won't stop. People won't stop unless there's legislation or unless the money is taken away from them. I really do think that we're going to have some form of elephant mammoth hybrid, which will have very few mammoth cells, probably 99% elephant cells, and they'll call it a woolly mammoth and they'll put it in a zoo and make loads of money, like a Jurassic Park kind of thing. Honestly, I really think that.
What do you think?
I'd go see it.
No.
What can I say? I'm so easily led.
I think I'd go too. That's awful. But I think I would.
Do you think that we're likely to see, because it's one of those things, like bringing back the woolly mammoth, it's one of those sort of holy grails culturally. Do you think that there's going to be sort of like rogue research that will eventually...
I think Lara's right. I think funding is where it's all based. I mean, you can only do the research that you're able to be funded to do. So I guess if there's governments that want to get behind that, or private enterprise that want to do it.
Dr. John Hammond, obviously.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think there'd be better animals, though, to bring back.
Cybertooth tiger.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, obviously not to... Not to say that this is a good thing to do.
So I'd love to know what people make of this, because there's sort of the 50-50 debate on this, right? A lot of people say there's no environment for many of these animals, and bringing them back without any opportunity to reproduce, live healthy, happy, mentally healthy lives, because they're completely isolated in a world where they have no no family and no heritage.
Absolutely.
Heritage is the wrong word, but you know, they've got no... They've got nothing to learn from, and they don't know what they're, you know, there's nothing, no backstory to borrow from X Factor. You know, like, is this a good idea? And then there's other people who say, look, you know, to have these animals back, even in a zoo, to learn from them and to see them would be extraordinary. You can let us know, 5316 for 30 cents. I kind of understand if we could find a way to give them a habitat, and we could find a way to not use up like endangered African elephant embryo or eggs, that would be probably a good idea. Susan, this is a kind of a strange paper as well. This is to do with F's and V's. It seemed to me that the researchers were making extraordinary leaps, but maybe you made more of it.
Yeah, so I think, I'm with them, on the shorthand. So what this paper shows is that what humans ate over the last few thousand years has changed the shape of our jaw, so that we then incorporated different letters into our new language. So ultimately, the letters F and V weren't in the language of Homo sapiens up to very recently on the scale.
Is that right?
Yeah. So let's say Homo sapiens started to talk around 300,000 years ago. The letters F and V, or those sounds, only came into play around 4,000 to 6,000 years ago.
Oh.
So on scales of things, they're very new letters. So if you say I'm going to ask both of you to say the word fun.
Fun.
Fun. Fun. And van.
Van. Van.
So
van.
Both of those are what it's called labiodental sounds, and that means that your top teeth have to touch your bottom lip. So van.
Oh yeah, fun. Yeah, yeah.
And so originally what happened when, so Homo sapiens are born with this overbite, so where your top teeth stick out a little bit from your bottom teeth. Oh. But chewing really...
We're all trying to do it now. We look so
stupid. It's quite funny, actually. I was there yesterday. My bias. But ultimately, Homo sapiens were born with that overbite. But then as they chew hard food and tough food and steaks, the bottom jaw gets worn away the teeth, and the jaw moves forward to compensate for that. So then you no longer have a bar. So trying to say the word fun.
Is an overbite where your top bit is behind or in front of?
In front of. So exactly, as Jonathan.
So I've got News Talk TV. So you pull your top bit, you sort of jut your jaw forward.
You get your teeth to meet.
That's an underbite.
That's the underbite.
That's the underbite.
Okay.
So if you get your teeth to meet exactly on top of each other, this is what's called an edge-to-edge bite.
I can't say fun, no.
And it's very hard to say fun in that sense.
I can't believe I'm paid for this.
Fun. Humans ultimately evolved had this overbite, but then as they went to adulthood, because they were chewing really hard food, the jaw moved forward, and you couldn't say these, you couldn't make the sound anymore. So what happened is when farming came into play, so when you started to eat, humans started to eat softer foods like cheese and soups, maybe a stew, more so than a soup, but they started to lose this, you know, movement of the jaw. So they retained the overbite that were born with as humans. And so because of that, then they think this paper from Science, which is published in Science, believed that there's a very strong correlation between the loss of the movement of the jaw, so the retaining of the overbite, and then
but hang on a second, weren't we eating berries and stuff?
Yeah, so they're
it's not like we were eating rocks the whole time.
No,
right?
But so hunter-gatherers are this. So the paper has looked at this. This is the argument that makes this paper quite strong. It's a multi-method approach. So they looked at not just kind of one thing, but a few different things. So the first thing that they looked at was they actually just biomechanical modelling of the jaw. And they showed that it's a lot harder to say, as you've just demonstrated, to say these consonant sounds, 29% it's 29% easier to say them when you have the overbite. And then they looked at the types of societies that people came from where the languages were developed. And so only one quarter of the 7,000 languages, of the 7,000 languages that they looked at, one quarter of them, of the hunter-gatherers, were the people who didn't develop this. So they only had one quarter the amount of V's and F sounds in their languages compared to farming backgrounds. So hunter-gatherers, yes, you think berries, but they also ate meat and chewed things off the bone and steaks. And so it's not just sort of...
I love the way you furrow your brow and sort of like make these sort of ripping motions. It's been very visual, this whole thing, which has worked out great for radio. Into the thing. Our third story has to do with a regeneration process inside the human body, at least that is shown in animal systems, that might be useful for us.
So I guess we've talked about regeneration before, and a lot of people would have heard of the fact that if you cut a salamander's leg off, what happens is the cells at the tip of the stump will do a thing called de-differentiation. So they were muscle, bone and skin cells, and they become basically embryonic cells essentially again. And then they grow out and out and out, and they make a limb. And a starfish is even more impressive. If you cut off one of his legs and keep a part of the central disc, that leg will grow a starfish. They're absolutely amazing. But humans obviously cannot do this. And it's kind of the holy grail. I mean, Luke Skywalker would never have had to have a robotic arm if we could just regenerate. And we should have been able to in the movie. Anyway, so a paper that's just published in Science uses an animal called the three-banded panther worm, which definitely sounds cooler than it looks. It's a flatworm. And first of all, what the paper did was release the entire genome sequence of this worm, which is already pretty cool. But what they found was that there's a type of gene called the early growth response gene, so EGR. And that turns on all of the cells that allow this panther worm to regenerate when part of it is cut off. And we have it. Humans have this EGR gene. And what they need to activate it is a funny thing. It's actually part of the non-coding, or kind of in inverted commas, junk DNA. So about 98% of our DNA is what we call junk DNA. It doesn't make proteins. But the switch to turn on this EGR is hidden in this junk DNA, and it's squished right up in the middle of it. And when there's an injury to the animal, the DNA opens out, it unfolds, and it allows this switch inside the non-coding DNA to turn on all of the things that allow the worm to regrow. Now, human cells turn on EGR if they're damaged as well. So if you put cells in a dish and you damage them, EGR turns on. But it doesn't do the downstream things that it does in the worm. So there's a huge amount of work still to go to figure out those downstream things.
But I suppose the idea that rather than having to flick 1,000 switches with exactly. some sort of medicine or therapy, that if we found a way to flick the EGR... That if we could start that cascading of processes, it might be a way to regenerate in a more smooth and a probably quicker way.
If the EGR did the thing that it does in the worms, it doesn't in humans, which is the problem. You can flick it on and it goes on, but it doesn't have the downstream connections. So if you could find a simple way for it to have the downstream connections, which may not be there, but anyway, if you could, then you could talk about regeneration in humans or in invertebrates. Invertebrates. It's hard to say invertebrates.
At least you have the jaw for it.
True.
We want to talk about death metal.
Yeah, so death metal, I don't know if you listen to death metal, but death metal is a subsection of heavy metal. And as it gets a bad rep, I think it's fair to say, a lot of parents and religious groups often call out for the fact that it can lead to desensitization of people, fans who listen to this music, especially when they're looking at violent images or listening to when they see violent situations. They can be worried that there's desensitization. Also, a hard word to say. desensitization.
Let's pretend this is going really well.
So, I suspect this professor who ran this study in Macquarie University in Australia might be a fan of this, but it's published in the Royal Society of Open Access. And he has looked at whether or not death metal fans are desensitized to these violent images. The best way to kind of look at it is, you know, the idea of like horror. It's the musical equivalent of a horror film. So that's sort of really gory, really, really intense.
Violent. Intense imagery in the music, really like dark sounds and discord and sort of...
A lot of screaming, etc. And so what they took was 48 non-fans and 32 fans of this music. And the idea was that non-fans would focus more on violent imagery. Now, this is normal. So if you're shown somebody a violent image and a neutral image, most of us will actually perceive the violent image more. And it's based on maybe threat perception, you know, that you keep an eye out on the things that are dangerous. So they did this study called using a technique called binocular rivalry, where one eye was shown a violent image and one eye was shown a neutral image. And then all the people involved in the study were asked to press a button while looking at these images for 60 seconds and say, OK, well, which of them does your eye focus on? Because your eyes can't focus on more than one.
And so the idea of this is you show people violent images and the people who are listening to death metal presumably don't even notice
they
the
don't
violent
even
images
because they're so there's neutral as the neutral image. Exactly. And they did this while listening to music. So they did this while listening to a song called Eaten by a Bloodbath, which is the heavy metal death metal song. Mm-hmm. And then they also did started listening to an upbeat pop song, which I might suggest that, what do you think it might be?
Justin Bieber.
It was Happy by Pharrell Williams. Oh, yeah.
Okay,
so what they noticed was that everybody noticed the violent images the same amount. So the people who listened to, you know, violent music don't, you know, notice them as much as people who don't listen.
Love to hear from you if you are a fan of this music. My understanding is people who are real rockers are actually people who are extraordinary empathy and have hearts of gold. They're really genuinely
some
of the nicest
the
people I know
up, yeah.
have like into the most hardcore and violent music.
Yeah.
Well, listen, it has been bonhutic having you both on. Susan Kelleher and Laura Duggan, thanks very much. Earwax. It can tell you certain things about a person, like how much you prioritize personal hygiene, for example. It can't tell you how stressed you were feeling in 1996, though, unless, that is, you happen to be a whale. Stephen J. Trumbull from the Department of Biology at Baylor University joins me now to tell me more. Welcome to the program, Stephen. Tell me, why do you work with whale wax?
Well, I mean, the short answer is they've been aging whales for over a century using whale earwax, earwax plugs. And it just so happens that myself and my colleague Sasha Yusenko came up with this idea a number of years ago that if we look at the individual bands that they use for aging, if we can get some sort of a chemical signature from these bands, that we should be able to kind of reconstruct their chemical profile through their life. So short answer, sort of.
That is really disgusting. Can I ask, what did you say plugs? Are they... do you actually mean like a plug of gunk that comes out of the ear in a solid ball?
Yeah, it looks more like it's kind of like like a candle. It's typically they're 10, 15, 20 centimeters long, but the longest one we've ever received was 53 centimeters long and weighed about 800 and some odd grams.
2 feet long, almost.
Yeah. So they're a good. That's from a bowhead whale, but yeah, I mean they're it's not quite a ball, but it's kind of long and tapered at the end. It's got some nice, smell to it, as you might guess.
So I have so many questions. The first question is, why work with whale wax? You're saying that you can age whales by earwax. Do you mean like counting the rings of a tree or something?
Absolutely. That's exactly what the old whalers figured this out decades ago. Literally counting the rings and, dividing by two, and you get a really nice approximation for age. And, my colleague who did work with sediment cores, he was like, oh, sort of like a sediment core in the animal. And then we kind of came up with the idea that there's probably chemicals within those individual rings or lines. And sure enough, it worked. And so we were able to kind of move on from there.
Well, I want to get into that in a bit. But first, how do you get hold of the earwax of a whale? I'm imagining a sort of a Moby Dick scenario with a Q-tip.
Yeah, not quite. Most of the whale plugs that we get are from museums, and museums have been collecting whale earplugs for since 1909, believe it or not.
What?
Who
is doing that, and why?
Well, I mean, you have to understand that museums collect everything, right? And this was during the whaling era. They would collect various tissues, ovaries, eyeballs. The earplugs, because they use them for aging, they just stuck them in a jar, and the museums took them and they've archived them and they've kept them for all these years, and the science has finally caught up with this whale earplug research, and so it's
someone finally found something to do with the dozens of jars of ancient whale earwax.
To give you some idea of how many, we were just in a museum in Canada and they have about 4,000 earplugs.
Oh my God. So how does the earwax form? Is it do whales' ears function exactly the way humans do? I mean, I know they're mammals, but is it a similar process?
No, that's a really good question. So the baleen whales are the only whales that we know of that have earplugs. And yes, they generate earwax much like we do. They have a tympanic membrane. It's a little bit different structure as far as that, because they listen at a different frequency than we do. So their kind of anatomy is a little different. But they produce earwax just like we do. The difference is that, you know, our earwax is exposed to the external environment, whereas theirs is basically trapped inside their head. And the only way you can get to it is from a dead whale. When an animal washes up on the beach dead or is floating out there dead, I mean, this is the only way you can get to it. You cannot get to it from the outside of the animal like you can humans.
So this is sebum, is that right? It's collected sebum from the sebaceous gland. It's the stuff that makes our hair greasy and gives people pimples, right?
Right. It's keratin, lipids, and wax kind of mixed together, just like our earwax. I mean, human earwax is, you know, it's, you know, there's, depending on your genetics, some's really dry, some's really liquidy and soft. Just depends. But yeah, similar.
And so does it vary amongst whales, or does all earwax, once you know one, once you've met one whale's earwax, you've met them all?
No, very different. The bowhead whale was very kind of liquidy and almost gelatinous. And some of the other species are smaller and very kind of dense. And some are long and skinny. Some are short and stout. It's just species different.
You know, I've never said this on this program, but I actually feel properly nauseous talking about this. And I've talked about almost everything. This is really grossing me out. So you've got this earwax, and you study, you know, how old the whales are from studying these ancient plugs. What else can you learn from poking around in the dirt?
Well, I mean, as far as the earwax is concerned, I mean, the interesting part is, and you've kind of touched on this, is we have an age component to the animal. So if we know the animal, let's say, died in 1970, and then we just back calculate, because we know the age from the plug, that we can go back to, you know, 1930. And so now we have a record of chemicals from the, you know, 1940s and 50s and 60s, and what chemicals have been taken up by the animal, what's been produced by the animal, and like how many pregnancies, how many...
Wow. So you're seeing hormones then preserved in the wax?
Seeing hormones, we're looking at pregnancy hormones, stress hormones. We're actually getting DNA from these layers now. So we're looking at DNA methylation and how that pertains to stress. We know, you know, yeah, we can look at it in relation to sea surface temperature and shipping noise and see how these animals are influenced and how they respond to their environment. We see pregnancy rates. We see all sorts of neat things. What contaminants are coming on board and what are going off of the animal through like lactation and things like that. So the amount of information we're getting from these earplugs is absolutely astounding.
It sounds like you can sort of press rewind on these whales to sort of understand in pretty good detail the things that happened to them. Why is that important to learn about?
Well, it's important because if we know what the animal and hence the population is experiencing, and if we can kind of correlate that or associate that with various, you know, environmental stressors like the war, like whaling, like sea surface temperature change. And then we get an idea of like how to better manage the population moving forward.
So you said the war. Do you really think you could see stress patterns dated to a particular year during which there was a conflict, and that would turn up in the wax of a whale's ear?
Yeah, we actually saw that. We just published that in our latest paper. So during the 39 to 45, we see an increase in stress in the animals we were looking at, and a decrease in the whaling effort. So we probably attribute that to whatever war activity is going on, especially noise. You know, so much more noise in the ocean, ships and, you know, submarines, torpedoes, planes, you name it. So, yeah, these animals definitely were stressed out during that period of time relative to what we saw prior to that period.
Wow, that is so interesting. I was just thinking though, you reminded me of the hormone changes that happen during adolescence and mating time. Are they the sort of things that you can also see in the wax data?
Exactly. Yeah, we do see that. And because we have a lifetime profile of an animal, and we can baseline correct for the individual, we can see if it's had elevations in, you know, testosterone, and this is how we can determine pregnancies or potential pregnancies. So we can see that.
So you'd be able to tell from earwax of a 100-year-old whale how many babies it had.
Yes, and actually for the study, we're just about ready to publish another study that actually we look at three or four different species of whales, and we get pregnancy rates, and we're finding all sorts of new information about these species.
Which is quite exciting, right? Because a lot of whales you don't know much about because of the nature of their migration pattern. A lot of whales just disappear for a very long time, and we don't know a huge amount about them. To get information from their earwax as to how many babies they have, and potentially what waters they were in, because I presume there's some sort of way you can trace geography, can we, in terms of the chemicals found in their earwax that relates to geographical location?
Absolutely. You're right. We can determine pregnancy rates, as you kind of pointed out, you can't really do unless you're, you know, traipsing about on a ship in the ocean following whales for their whole life, which is you can't do because it costs too much money, and who's got that kind of time? So, and yes, using stable isotope signatures, we can see sort of where they've gone, what sort of a trophic regime they're kind of playing around in at the time. And we know that most of the plugs that we've been are working at this far are northern hemisphere. And so we have a fairly good idea of like where they've been, especially from the whaling era, where they've been captured or hunted. So we have a fairly good idea of what's going on there. And using kind of going backwards from that, using the stable isotopes, we can sort of figure out where they've gone, where they've come from.
That's like you get so much information from some gook in an animal's ear. What about other animals? Can you do the same for coyotes or, I don't know, I mean, like what sort of information could you get? Could you analyze my earwax and see how many babies I've fathered?
No.
The answer, if my wife is listening, is just two.
Yeah, that's right. we could, for a price, we could validate that for you. No, you couldn't do that because we don't really lay down wax continuously through our life and form a plug.
Not typically.
Right. And plus, like I said, it's exposed to the external environment. So whatever's in the external environment can also get into your plug, your earwax, as far as a human. But
are there other animals, though?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because if
animals.
You think of whales, obviously whales are ideal because it's internal their whole life. Are there other animals that have that ear canal closed off that you can get lifetime longitudinal data from?
We don't think so. We've heard some kind of anecdotal evidence about like sperm whales. We haven't got any plugs yet. There's research that have been done on like whiskers and some baleen from whales.
What's a baleen?
Baleen is the filter feeding mechanism, and we've been able to isolate chemicals from that. Now, you're not going to get the lifetime signature. It's more of a kind of a few years at the most, but it's still pretty nice and worthwhile to play around with. There are people doing research on claws of various animals because they kind of grow continuously through life. And there's, like I said, whiskers, and there's some hair studies out there on like metals and things like that. But as far as lifetime work, there's really nothing that really compares with the earplug.
I spoke last year to a woman who was collecting whale snot, and it seems that, you know, that there are lots of people doing pretty disgusting work on the orifices of whales. And I wonder if you guys have a social network or something, like a Facebook group.
We should.
I think you should. Yeah. I think you should. I'm probably taking this as far as I want to take it, to be honest. Probably a little bit further. Well, one question, I'll close my ears, but people might be interested before we go. I wasn't going to ask it at the time because I really don't want to hear this. So I'll ask you the question and you can answer, but I'm not going to hear the, I'm just going to say thank you very much. So the question is, what does the earwax smell like?
So, earplugs are, like I said, like a candle, a fairly kind of malleable and soft, and they're very fishy smelling, as you can imagine, and very, very pungent. And so this is what grad students are good for. They get to play around with the earplugs and have all that smell to play around with, where I get to sit in my office and write the papers.
Okay, I'm getting a signal from my producer, so I'm going to take my fingers out of my ears now and say thank you, Stephen Shay Trumbull, PhD Associate Professor at the Department of Biology at Baylor University. Enjoy the rest of your life.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thanks, Stephen. That was great. Take care, man. Bye bye.
All right.
I didn't know what else to say to the man. You know, I mean, great. Great that he's doing it. Super. It's like, you don't need to know everything, right? And I think that's one of those things that, and I'm not particularly squeamish. It's just, I don't know. There was a kid in my school who used to make jokes about toilets stuff all the time. And it just gave me the sort of I don't like hearing toilet jokes. As a result of it, I'm not a particularly formal person. Like, it's just that sort of makes me go, and I felt that way about the whale wax thing. I just didn't want to do the feature, but actually, it was very interesting, wasn't it?
It's pretty cool to know how whales felt about World War II.
It is amazing. It's amazing. At the same time, I just wish we were talking about something else, their whiskers or something. I don't know. Now it's time to get through to some of your emails and texts. And look, the argument when it comes to vaccinations, which we talked about last week and, of course, got a huge amount of anti-vax stuff on, the arguments are, do you give a voice and appear balanced by giving voice to those in the small minority? Now, it's absolutely certain there are a small minority who believe that vaccines are harmful. Do you give them oxygen or do you not? And just basically not mention them. I think I'd like to, because a lack of understanding that other people are not motivated by shit is actually one of the huge drivers for hate and violence and just meanness in the world, right? That most people are intrinsically good and they do what they do for a good reason. So people who call anti-vaxxers stupid or they're idiots, it's really unhelpful, because people are basing their opinions on their own experiences. And if I have a child and they get sick and I hear other people and I add up two and two and I might get 2.5, I can totally understand how someone might do that. And to step out of that world and to hear from somebody who is not in my group or my community say, oh, listen, vaccines are actually really good for you, even though it looks like, in this case, I totally understand why you might be upset that you think that the vaccine has caused harm. The chances are it probably didn't. That's not what you want to hear. And we know how the brain works in terms of, we listen to the voices that we agree with and we shut down voices we don't agree with. And once we have made an opinion, it's very hard to change that opinion. So I want to talk about the responses we got regarding vaccines. So first one, a doctor would never say vaccines are bad. Do you realize how much money they make from them? Don't be so naive. And this comes back to the lack of understanding that people are not motivated by being a shit to each other. And of the people in the world, it's sad to, and this, I don't mean in a patronizing way, it's sad to think that someone believes doctors are motivated by money alone. Think of that. that they get a bit of money in their pocket, and so they would therefore be happy to endorse something that harms a child. That idea is, when it's teased out, just doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't. And if you view doctors like that, then your experience of the medical system and of doctors, it must be so different to mine and to many others. And I'd love to unpack that, why you would feel that way. But if you would agree that doctors started that career because they wanted to help people rather than they wanted just to get the money, because doctors work kind of hard. They go through a lot. To think that they're motivated just by that, it, you know, to me, is not fundamentally understanding why someone spends their life trying to help others. Pat from Cork says, vaccines have and are destroying children, and the only reason these diseases are increasing is the influx of immigrants into Europe. So, Pat, there is no evidence to suggest that. And that's the first thing. I have to go off evidence. But then I also go beyond that, and I look at the people who have been studying these things for some time. And I have to look at the sources of information that I have and put them together. And this, if you use this approach to trying to figure out whether something is true or not, then with the case of vaccines, you must surely realize that the people working in this, all of them working in this, all of them agreeing, it would take an extraordinary leap of faith to believe in a conspiracy theory of that girth, to use the only appropriate word I can think of. The influx of immigrants into Europe, again, I think there is a lack of understanding as to why people move from one country to another. This has nothing to do with the measles thing, but the idea that an immigrant isn't welcome here is based in the idea that this thing that you call your neighborhood is your own. And that, when we think about human beings as animals and the fact that we've always moved, the idea that I own this because I was born here by a roll of the dice seems to me such a crazy idea to hold on to. And yes, it was different before, where we were all white, brown, of different colors and different cultures stuck apart. But some of those had life a little bit better and some of those didn't. And I don't know, I think the idea that we should just keep it the way it was suits us who have been privileged and wealthy pretty well. It doesn't suit the rest of the world. And I think a lack of understanding about what immigrants want and where they come from and what they want and what they contribute is again causing problems.
It was also never the way it was. People are like, oh, we were always Celtic, but there was like Celts, Vikings, Picts. You have like the English.
Spanish came up in the southwest.
Any idea of your own cultural identity is probably not properly taught through or not properly understood. All of the European cultures interbred. Germans aren't just Germans. There's Slavs. It's a complete illusion.
Yeah.
That people who don't have any understanding of history like to take on board, but actually it's a total illusion.
Yeah, it is. And Dr. Adam Rutherford talks about this eloquently in some of his books. And I think to feel that, Pat, you probably have formed those opinions based on looking around and having your own experiences and then reading from sources that you agree with. And that is totally understandable. But I would hope that you know, with what went on in New Zealand this weekend, that people might try a little bit more to understand the people that are different from them by trying to know them a little bit more if they feel that something is a threat. And I think that has been sorely lacking in the past 5 to 10 years. Nolan Cork says, in the early 80s, Ronald Reagan and the US Registrar General stood up before Congress and swore links between tobacco and cancers were doubtful. Agent Orange is sprayed on own food by millions of gallons, now proven to cause cancer and still in use. Roundup can be bought anywhere. The makers of thalidomide never paid a penny in compensation to the many thousands of victims. Context and comparisons are needed in vaccines debate, although I'm sure they're very good for you, as well as being worth billions in offshore profits. You're talking about how we were told one thing and now we know something else. And I totally understand that. And it is absolutely true that in many cases, we have been told one medicine is good for you and turned out that it hasn't been. However, the number of cases of those cases versus cases where medicine has helped us is overwhelming. And the number of studies that have gone to check the veracity by lots of different sources of this particular vaccine, it has been unmatched in history. And the reason it's been unmatched in history is because it is so useful for mankind to not have measles. The comparison between medicines that have turned out to be, that were said to be good for us and now bad for us, I totally understand that. If we think, look about tobacco and cancer, I get that. We look at MMR and measles, it has been so soundly and thoroughly investigated by scientists from all over the world. The resounding evidence suggests that it is safe. It is inconceivable to think that all of a sudden, after all this evidence, suddenly we'll find out that it's terrible for 10% of the population. It is possible that these studies that have been extraordinary exhaustive. I can't think of a medicine that has been tested as widely as this and studied as widely as the MMR jab because of these very reasons of questionability. It is theoretically possible that 0.0001% of the population may have adverse effects that have been missed. But if we look at the number of the population that have taken this, that have taken it healthily and now are able to survive and coming in contact with measles, there is no question that this is a safe vaccine for the population. And there's no question that even if there is the case of these side effects of these cases and 0.0001% of the population, or whatever that number may be, the general population benefits so much by having destroyed measles and having eradicated it from modern life that it is unquestionably the right thing to do for a parent when it comes to your child and the vaccine. There's no argument with that. But I understand your questioning. We were told this and then we were told that. They're not comparable when we talk about the amount of evidence that we have for MMR versus Agent Orange. They're just not comparable. Vaccines. My son's biopsy showed measles in his gut. He did not get it from the wild. I worked with special needs children over 30 years. In the 90s, only 1 in 20 children with autism, later years, children with autism were knocking down the door looking for services. So it's definitely not better diagnosis. You can't miss a child with autism. As for the immune system, we should be building up our immune system through better nutrition, eating non-processed, chemical-free food and eating organic. That's from Anne. And absolutely, I think, you know, eating chemical-free food, I mean, chemical, of course, there's chemicals in everything. You know, there's chemicals in apple. So I understand the idea, and I think absolutely we should be eating fresh food that is as unprocessed as possible. There's no question processed meat is not as healthy as organic meat. We should be eating less meat, and we should be eating organic where possible just because of the processing and the environmental impact and lots of other reasons. I absolutely agree with organic chemicals. When you say chemical-free food, a chemical is simply a substance that consists of matter. That's the definition of a chemical, which makes it prevalent in everything. Apples have chemicals and so on. So the idea of chemical-free food doesn't make any sense to me. But I understand what you mean. You're talking about things added, additives and so on. The question about autism is that now there's lots more people with autism. I do think there is an increase in autism. I don't think it's as pronounced as we might believe because of misdiagnosis and also people just living with it. And sometimes in the 80s, just putting someone in a mental home and not looking for any diagnosis, not dealing with that issue at all. So I think the question around autism, the rise in autism, is a valid one. I don't think it's as pronounced as you describe it there. And I think there are reasons why we are seeing more of it. But to say you cannot miss a child with autism, I think is fundamentally not understanding autism, because you absolutely can. The autism is on a spectrum, and people who live with autism have various levels of presentations for that particular condition. Look, we got so many of these, and I wanted to get to as many of them. Some of them were really based in pseudoscience, getting information that almost certainly came from Facebook, where people had put up stuff to scare other people, the motivations of which I really don't understand. But once again, the overwhelming evidence is that vaccines are extraordinarily safe. While a company may make money selling them, that doesn't mean that every government in the world that subscribes to this vaccine thinks it's okay to poison children for cash. I just don't buy that. And so for me, I understand why you listen to these sources, but I think you need to listen to other sources too. Lots of people asking about the soundproofing that we talked about in the news. There is a device that was devised to completely cancel out noise. One person living in town, another person living in an airport saying, can I get this material? Because I have a lot of sound, and if I put it in a vent, it's just going to ruin the soundproofing in my room. It's not technically available just yet, but there's probably other options that will help you better than finding this new sort of material. We were talking about John Dunbar's work, working with venom in animals and looking at the responses to the human body and so on. Ivan says, how do people build up an immunity to necrotic venoms from rattlesnakes as shown in the States with those crazy preachers? John says, in general, humans cannot become immune to snake venom after exposure to venom from an earlier bite in a way that will save them. They can produce some antibodies, but think about it like a virus. You become exposed or get vaccinated, and after a couple of weeks, your immune system will have produced memory cells. So the next time you get that virus, your immune system will start producing antibodies after about 24 hours to fight it. The key thing here is the time frame to adaptive immunity. The virus takes time to replicate in your body. By the time it's making you feel ill, i.e. 24 hours, your immune system will have abundant numbers of antibodies to fight it. But when you're bitten by a snake, it doesn't take 24 hours for venom to build up to dangerous levels. In fact, the venom is probably all denatured and died by then. You are instead injected with a full bolus of venom that acts immediately. Some species can kill people within 20 minutes, but usually over a few hours. So even if you've acquired adaptive immunity to a particular species, it will still take about 24 hours for those memory cells to fight back, by which time you're dead. These self-immunizers who repeatedly inject themselves with sublethal doses of venom, and they can literally take a full-on bite from a black mamba, they need to keep doing this regularly, like every week, in order to for the adaptive immunity to be constantly producing antibodies. Oh, I see. So these people are constantly exposing themselves to the antibody, to the bite, to continue the antibody production, because if you have to start again, you won't survive that bite. But by injecting yourself with venom is extremely dangerous, also because snake venom is highly allergenic. They literally risk becoming hypersensitive, and this can be more lethal than the venom toxicity itself. In the case of preachers, they often handle in a way that the snakes don't feel threatened or probably cool them down, and quite often bites are not life-threatening. Snakes can control the amount of venom they deliver. Sometimes they even give a dry bite. But overall, quite a few preachers have been killed by venom, even several over the last year or two. We're also talking about Mark Miodovnik's book, Stuff Matters, and metals. And someone says, what is it that makes a polymer different to a metal? Polymer is plastic, and a metal is not. So a polymer is made up of chains of carbon, and a metal is obviously not. Another says, hi, what's the professor's name? That was Mark Miodovnik, and the book is called Stuff Matters. I should say we got loads of texts about your coincidences, which we really enjoyed. We're going to be following up with some of them. So know that we did read them and we appreciate them. And some of those you might hear in a later podcast. Steve says, here's a great coincidence for you to finish off. Sean Connery was once stopped for speeding by a policeman called James Bond. Fact. I don't know if it's a fact, but I like it, so I'm not going to Google it. That's it from us for this week. Thanks for listening. Aidan McKelvey was series producer, and Peter Molloy was on sound. We'll be back later in the week with more Future Proof Extra and Future Proof Gold. In the meantime, stay curious.